morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Check.
And now, the news.
Check.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video. Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts to disregard all safety rules. Here, your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the podcast that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. That's the normal menu for our weekly show. This time, we're bringing you a special Technorama. If you're a new listener, welcome to the show. Don't forget to check out the website at www.chuckchat.com. Have a listen to Technorama, a strange but fun show to feed your inner geek. While you're there, give some of the other podcasts a listen too. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. I just want to say how much I really appreciate you giving us your time on this drive, run, walk, downtime, or wherever you happen to be listening. Thank you. In April 2006, Craig and I interviewed a man by the name of John Chatterton from the History Channel's Deep Sea Detectives. This time, we're proud to bring you his partner, diver, explorer, and expedition leader, Richie Kohler. In March, I had the honor of not only meeting John and Richie, but getting a signed copy of Shadow Divers by Robert Curzon and sharing dinner with them. That's a treat I won't soon forget. Thank you, gentlemen. The reason I wanted to talk with Richie today is because he really brings a human element, a connection to diving. Even if you're not a diver, I think you'll enjoy what he has to say. To paraphrase something he said to me, it's one thing to dive a shipwreck or see and touch artifacts, but when you meet a survivor or a family member of a survivor, that gives you a direct link. Something else a little different about this particular Technorama, Craig couldn't be with me for this interview, but I do have two very special in-studio guests, my parents, George and Betty Tomasi. I've asked them to join me today, not only because we share a love for the sport of scuba diving, we are also fans of Deep Sea Detectives and love the book Shadow Divers, which I recently found out is being turned into a major motion picture. George and Betty's sport diving career spans 5 decades, which gives them a rare vantage point from which to help me with this interview. Welcome to Technorama, Richie. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, and you're lucky because you've caught me out of the water. I've been diving for the last 4 days, so otherwise there would just have been a dial tone right now.
You don't have underwater comms that we can tie into in some way?
No, actually we do, but if I'm diving with helium, it would
sound something like this, and people would go, that's not really Richie Kohler.
I don't even want to know how you did that on demand.
A lot of experience, and I bet you there's some residual helium popping around in here for sure. But no, believe it or not, I was just up in Maine, of all of the wonderful places we could be diving in spring, 41 degree water, doing my, believe it or not, instructor training.
Oh, no kidding.
No kidding. I've decided to go over to the dark side and become a TDI-SDI technical dive instructor. After 30 years of really enjoying diving, it's been a big part of my life. Ever since I'm about 16 years old, I've identified myself as a diver. I've decided now to give a little bit back. I feel that with 30 years of experience and insight into technical and wreck diving, I have a lot to offer prospective students. So,
well, now that we've read the last chapter in the book, let's flip a little earlier before. Some of the people may know you from Shadow Divers, or some from the History Channel's Deep Sea Detectives. My dad would like to lead us off with the first question.
Thanks, Chuck. Richie, it's an honor to have this opportunity to speak with you. We're fans, have been for a while, and very impressed with all of your accomplishments. But we've wondered about your background. How did you get started? Where did you grow up? How did you get into diving? Can you tell us a little about that?
Not a problem, but let me counter you by saying I am flattered with that introduction, that preamble. I'm just a very lucky and fortunate diver whose origins in the sport was a gift from my father. My father is a sport fisherman and has been most of his life. And as a young boy, he would often take us children. I'm the eldest of 3 children, and we would go fishing with my dad. And for no other reason than to maintain his boat he took a scuba diving lesson when I was about 8 years old and brought me, his oldest son, to sit on the edge of the pool. And as I sat there and I watched my dad put that double hose regulator over his head, and I know I'm dating myself a little bit there, but the reality is that same summer, the Apollo program was going full score, and I watched as Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. So this young, impressionable boy was already smitten with becoming an astronaut, and then watched the miracle of his dad go beneath the surface of the pool and breathing off of this, you know, high-tech scuba equipment. Well, I was hooked right then and there. And I was about 8 years old. So my father was the kind of man who instilled in his children a can-do attitude, definitely a touchy-feely type of man. He wanted you to be intimate with equipment and not be afraid of it. So at 8 and 9 years old, I was already learning how to doff and don a double hose regulator in our pool. I had been diving with him off beach entries. And by the time I was 12 years old, he tied a rope around my waist and allowed me to dive off the back of the pool, off the back of the boat in about 20 foot of water. And I always thought for years and years and years that my father loved me so much, that's why he tied that rope around me, because he didn't want anything to happen for me to get lost in the underwater world. But when I was telling this story once, he came over to me and goes, I hate to be the guy to tell you this, but the only reason why I did that was in case things turned out badly, I'd get my equipment back. So I have to give an attaboy to my dad for starting me off like this. And now, my brother and sister also had the same introduction, but it didn't bite them. Although they do share a love of the water, both of them have boats, both of them love to go boating and fishing. Fishing never really struck it for me. I'd much rather be down there with the fish than sitting on the boat with a pole, which it sometimes just seems like such a silly thing to do. You know, you can go down there and get them if you really want them that badly. Why would you want to sit in a boat? But that is how I got my start and my passion for diving. And then there was a series of events that occurred over a period of about 10 years where my mother and father became divorced and my mother moved to Florida, which for a young boy who's interested in scuba diving, I couldn't have gone to a better place. I became certified at the age of 16 years old in Florida and very quickly learned how to do spearfishing, tropical fish collecting as a means to support my diving habit and buying new gear. I also commercially spearfished, which for a short period of time where I was selling what I would spear. I tried cave diving, which scared the bejesus out of me, and I didn't go back into a cave for nearly 25 years. I'm really glad that I didn't wind up as a statistic. I mean, this was the early 70s when cave diving was in its infancy in Florida, and the deaths were counted in score. So, you know, these two young kids, 16 years old, venturing into a cave system with no training, no equipment, no proper equipment, it's surprising I didn't hurt myself or kill myself. So I'm glad that worked out well for me. But then as I graduated high school, I decided to join the family business, which was back up in New York City. So I moved back to the New York area, and for 2 years, my diving equipment stayed mummified in the basement of my father's glass company because I just didn't think that the diving was that good in New York. It wasn't until I walked into a dive shop in Eastern Long Island and I saw in the dive shop, I was actually there to fix their window. I was there for business. And I walked into the dive shop and I saw photographs of a diver swimming through what looked like a Hollywood film set. I mean, it was a bathroom and the diver was working or trying to turn the faucets in a sink, and there was a cabinet and a doorway. And as I looked more around the dive shop, I saw artifacts, and all of a sudden my love of history and my passion for diving and science all kind of seemed to gel at that moment. And I blurted out to the owner of the dive shop, I would like to dive that shipwreck. And the guy was like, hey, you don't understand. That's the Andrea Doria. That's an extremely difficult dive, and you know, you have to be an excellent diver. And I said to the guy, more surprising myself to him, I says, I'm going to dive that. I says, that looks really cool. And it would be about 4 years later, but ultimately I started diving back here in the New York, New Jersey area, cold water diving, and I learned the ropes of deep technical wreck diving, or at least what was considered deep and technical. They didn't use those terms of technical diving back then. It was just deep air diving. There was no trimix. There was no rebreathers. There were no dive computers. there wasn't even repetitive dive tables. If you were going to go deeper than 200 feet, you had to extrapolate them. You had to create dive tables. So all of this was the Wild West, if you will, for deep wreck diving and exploration. And I was on the cusp of that, the cutting edge of that wave as it swept through the Northeast dive community. And the reason for it was pretty much simple. I refer to it as the Wild West, and with good reason. Although there were some people that really wanted to just go and explore, and there were others that wanted to take pictures, the majority of the divers were there specifically to get artifacts. And in order to find artifacts, the majority of the shallower wrecks had already been found and, let's just say, picked over. So if you wanted to find the bell of a ship or a steering wheel, the helm or a telegraph or dishes or china or anything like that, you had to go further and deeper. And there was a bunch of fellows that I hooked up with that their nickname at the time were the deep freaks, the crazies, or the thugs. Not exactly what your mom would want you hanging out with, but these were some of the best divers. Their propensity for diving and adventure was matched only for their ability to consume mass quantities of beers on the boat ride home. And, you know, as a young man, I was totally wrapped up with these guys. I mean, they were part Viking, part diver, part pirate. It was just an incredible group of fellows from a very diverse background. I mean, one of them was an engineer, a bona fide rocket engineer from Grumman. The majority of them were mostly blue-collar workers with a few white-collar business types put in there. But these men, and they were men, they were about 10 years my senior, took this young Turk under their wing and taught me how not to kill myself. And the first things that they did was took my equipment, much like a veteran soldier or sergeant will take the new greenhorn and tell them what equipment to carry and what not to carry and how to configure it. These guys reshaped not only my dive kit, but my philosophy and my outlook about diving. And in no short way, everything that I have become and everything that I have done really stems from them preventing me from killing myself in those early days. And believe me when I tell you, diving to the excess of 200, 250 feet on air in the Northeast, where the visibility is measured in feet, just a few feet, the potential for tragedy was there. And it was only by these behaviors, these learned behaviors that they gave us, that they taught me, was I able to grow from that. Now, most of them, the majority of those guys don't dive anymore. And they stopped diving at that moment in time, that moment of technology. But diving technology has really grown in leaps and bounds. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. Otherwise, I'll monopolize this one question for the next half hour.
Oh, that's fascinating. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
This is Adam Savage from Mythbusters, and you're listening to Technorama with Chuck and Craig.
Richie, I wasn't aware until recently, maybe this is just my own fault, but you are the expedition leader for many of the trips that we see on television and read about in the magazines. The Titanic in 2005, the Britannic last year, the Lagardo this year. What does it take to put together an expedition like that? Where do you start?
Well, the way it begins is you have to be an expedition member. You have to start understanding what this really means. And let me back this up a little bit for you. There's two major differences between a charter and an expedition. A diving charter, you go out on a boat, everything's handled for you, the boat leaves the dock, the crew gets out there, they go and tie into the shipwreck, they come up, they brief you on what to expect, they help you get into your equipment, you go diving, you know what to expect, you come back, and then you go home. By its definition, in Webster's Dictionary, an expedition is a journey of some length and difficulty for a definite purpose. And right there, that's going to probably knock most charters right out of the box, because mm-hmm. it's going to be difficult. And that means that it's a team effort. Everybody's going to chip in. one of the things that differentiates an expedition from a charter is that there's a good chance that sometimes on an expedition, not everybody's going to get to dive. Some of the members of that expedition are going to be in a support role for the other people to go diving. That is, that they may be the crew on the top side, they may be safety divers, they may be operating in a rib, they may be dive marshal. These are just various little different things to help you support a dive operation. And again, we're not talking about sport diving. We're generally talking about deep technical diving where there is a potential for fatality if something goes wrong. And it doesn't have to be human error. It can be mechanical error. Simply something goes wrong with the equipment. If you're not fully supported in the field for that potential, and you're not prepared for it, and you haven't necessarily rehearsed for it and put into position all of these things, someone can get seriously hurt or killed. So as an expedition member, you're going to be expected at times to do things that you wouldn't normally do if you're paying on a charter. You know, and that could be something as simple as cooking dinner or fixing the toilet if the toilet breaks or taking a shift at the wheel. This is what an expedition does. If it's a charter, well, then it's going to be incredibly expensive, and you're going to need a very big boat to have a crew handle all of the little myriad tasks that I just kind of told you about. Let's just think about gas supply. On our most recent trip to Britannic, our Britannic expedition, two of the members of the expedition spent 3 days working almost 8 hours a day doing nothing but filling up the emergency tanks that we would only use in case one of the rebreathers went. They fill them, they analyze them, then they filled all of the rebreather bottles that were going to be used. It took 3 days for two men to do that with two boosters and three compressors.
Wow.
If that doesn't sound like a job, I don't know what else is. At the same time, other members of the expedition were turning an 80-foot fishing boat into a technical dive boat. We chartered this boat. There is no technical dive vessel in the island of Kea. We could have tried to bring one over and and had it motor over from England or from another area that we could have tried to bring in a dive boat, but the cost was prohibitive. So again, operating within a budget, we chartered a boat. We went to the lumber yard. We purchased lumber. We created benches for divers to sit on. We had the boat captain whip out his welder and created a ladder big enough for divers to climb up and down the 15 feet of freeboard this vessel had. Again, we were in Kea for a week preparing so that we could dive another week. So this is the difference between an expedition and a charter. And how do you get to do this? Well, number one, I have a background in construction. And since I was roughly 22 years old, I have been running teams of men on construction sites. So I guess in some way I've been in a position where I've been born to tell people what to do. Management skills, in other words, be able to use, focus your attention and people's strengths in the proper place. If they're not in the proper place, move them to the proper place so that everybody's getting the work done. Many hands make the work light. So that is what an expedition is. I have never been on a cave diving expedition, but I've read about like Kurt Bowen and others that go into these places in Mexico or in the Dominican Republic, and they backpack or they go in by mule or they drop in by helicopter, and they're doing a different version of an expedition. It's a land-based expedition to find caves, and it's just as grueling, it's just as demanding, and it's just as specified. Everybody has a task, everybody has a job, and the success or failure of the expedition can at some points, just like a submarine crew, fall on one person's shoulder doing the right thing at the right time.
Hi, Richie. This is Chuck's mom, Betty. We really appreciate this. This is very exciting for a couple of has-beens. The other day, George and I happened on the History Channel and saw you and John with your Lake Huron Cornelia B. Windiot, I think is the way it's said.
Yes.
Adventure and utilizing the research folks at U of M and that sort of thing. We were fascinated with it. And it occurred to me that, as you probably well know, we have a regular shipwreck graveyard at Isle Royale here in Lake Superior, and wondered if you had done anything with Isle Royale, had been there, had dived there. Do you have any interest in it?
No to the first part. I have not been diving in Isle Royale, but I will qualify this by saying, although I've been many wonderful places. There are so many more that are on my list. You know, my wish list of places to go diving is definitely extensive. And anyone who likes shipwrecks, who enjoys shipwreck history and the art of wreck diving, couldn't wish for a better place, a better repository than the Great Lakes. As you mentioned, I did a program on the Cornelia B. Windiat, and I also did one on the Carr Ferry in Milwaukee, which is the extent of my diving as of this spring. I do have more dives scheduled for this summer in the Great Lakes, and I'm looking forward to them because, again, the condition, even if we look at those two wrecks that I did, one is a wooden schooner that's sitting upright, her mast and cross trees are still in place, the deck house, helm wheel, hatch covers. It looks as if she just eased herself to the bottom ever so gently. The longboat or dory is still attached by a painter, by a line to the stern of the sailing vessel and is sitting upright on the seafloor or on the lake floor next to it with oars sitting in it. It is truly, in every sense of the word, a ghost ship.
Amazing.
I'm telling you, it looks like you could put sails on this thing and she'd sail across the bottom of the lake. If we go to the steamship or the car ferry SS Milwaukee, which sank in a hurricane,
we're familiar.
A great historic story. I mean, a terrible tragedy. Everyone died, but how the details of this all came out is absolutely fascinating. That basically there was a message case, which it looked like a thermos, but when a ship was going down in the Great Lakes prior to the advent or use of radio, they would actually put a message in a bottle, for want of a better term, and this thing washed up, and it washed up 2 or 3 days, I believe, after the loss of the vessel. So frozen dead men were washing up on shore, and no one had any clue what happened until finally this message case was found by a Coast Guardsman walking along the beach, and it was a case of dead men telling tales. So from someone who enjoys these histories, when you're diving a wreck like that, I mean, you can almost hear the storm when you're looking at these locomotives or train cars sitting there still loaded with their cargo inside this ferry laying on the bottom of the lake. It's a fascinating moment in history. Like all shipwrecks, these are moments, snapshots of history. And if you just enjoy the jungle gym, the adult playground aspect of diving, well, that's one thing. But if you can look beyond that and see the stories that these wooden planks and rusty ships hold, well, then you're rewarded on yet a whole other level. And as I said, the Great Lakes is a fascinating place for shipwreck history. And the condition of these shipwrecks, because of the fresh water, because of the lack of animal organisms that will eat the wood and such, it's an absolutely wonderful place for wreck divers.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And if you do get to Isle Royale, we think you'll enjoy it. But I certainly enjoyed your descriptive imagery of the Milwaukee. We're very familiar with the wreck, although we have not dived her.
This is John Chatterton from Deep Sea Detectives. You're with Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Richie, I think that it's evident at this point about your love of history, and from reading Shadow Divers, it certainly comes across that you're quite the humanitarian. You like the human touch to these stories, to these shipwrecks. You mentioned a story in March when we talked about the connection on the Shadow Divers, where you talked with the families and the surviving family members of the U-869, and you spoke of a story regarding the USS Lagardo. How did you get involved with that sub?
You know, it's one of these very unusual things in wreck diving. Generally, the lines that we follow in wreck diving, and I don't mean lines as in an anchor line or reels. I'm just talking about the historical trail is always much more poignant when the line is direct to a relative or a family member. it's so easy to be distanced from a shipwreck when everyone that has been connected with it has been dead for hundreds or dozens of years even. But when you can speak to someone whose dad, whose fiance, or whose wife or husband was a victim in that loss, all of a sudden now you, the diver, are making a direct connection. And in the case of the USS Lagardo, I had never heard of that submarine. Although I love World War II history, and although I have read many books on American submarines and their exploits in the Pacific, the most famous being like the Wahoo or the Tang, I had not heard of the USS Lagardo. I was doing a book tour for Shadow Divers. Random House had sent John Chatterton and myself and the author Robert Curson around the country to about 25 major cities and areas where we were going to go from bookstore to bookstore and promote the book Shadow Divers. And Traverse City was, believe it or not, one of our stops. And while I was there, a woman came over to me and said to me how touched she was by the fact that I had gone out of my way to travel to Germany to personally tell these families, you know, not what they knew. These people knew that their loved ones had died during the war. That's not what I was telling them. What I was telling them was that they no longer were laying anonymous at the bottom of the ocean, and that they had been found, and that the people that had found them cared about them. And in reality, it wasn't that I cared as much about the lost men. Of course I did, but you know, what I did care about was the fact that there was someone somewhere that didn't know what happened. And that so the real connection was to the people that were alive that didn't know what happened to their loved ones. So this woman told me that this was the part of the story that struck home with her because her dad had died on an American submarine, the USS Lagardo, during World War II. And that he had never come home, so she really appreciated that aspect of the story. Well, a year goes by, and lo and behold, a team of British divers diving out of Koh Samui, Thailand, stumble onto her dad's boat. They found the USS Lagardo, where it was laying in 250 foot of water for nearly 60 years. And this woman, Nancy Kenny, calls me up and lets me know that finally her dad's boat had been found in a similar way that we had been, you know, researching and figuring out the mystery behind U-869. These divers had contacted the families and the Wisconsin Maritime Museum about their find. And one thing led to another when Nancy, knowing who I was and what I did working on the History Channel doing underwater documentary, had put me in contact with Norma Bishop, who's the director at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, and they requested our services to go out to Thailand and document the wreck. And I'm gonna, although the other divers had made some video, it was amateur video. It wasn't, not that it wasn't good, but for a true forensic analysis of the wreck, you really needed a couple of things that these guys weren't doing, which is high-def continuous video of the shipwreck from stem to stern. Basically, the things that we had learned, not only working on deep-sea detectives, but also 7 years of working on the U-869. We had developed an understanding of what was needed and how to do it, and we had the equipment. The first thing that we needed to do was be able to spend some time. These guys were diving open-circuit scuba. We went out there with closed-circuit rebreathers, where these gentlemen were able to make 20-minute dives. We were doing one-hour dives on the bottom. We were operating three high-definition cameras and staying down there for an hour. So every dive we did, we brought home 3 hours of high-definition footage. And as I think you can realize, that even divers operating on the 20-minute bottom time, how long and how many dives it would have taken them to do what we did in one dive. So we stayed out there for a week. And one of the people that accompanied us was a grandson of one of the crew.
Wow.
And he was on board. He did not dive. He is a diver, but he's not capable of diving to 250 feet. So it was just really, again, poignant. So as I started by telling you, the lines in wreck diving are most poignant when they are direct and unbroken. And by having John Kenny on board the boat, with us, and his grandfather's tomb was just 200 feet below, for me, was as direct as you can get. And if that's not making a difference as a wreck diver, I really don't know what else I could do. So for me, that's the best part. That's the best payoff, to be able to provide comfort or an answer or closure to people who have suffered a tremendous and tragic loss.
This is David Levy, amateur astronomer, lover of the night sky, and comet discoverer. You are listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Richie, this is George, Chuck's dad, one more time.
Hi, George.
We've been around for a long time, as you have, and we've seen the diving equipment and the sport of diving change over the last 30 or 40 years. When we started, it was pretty simplistic and pretty easy to get into. Now it's become much more sophisticated in terms of mixed gases and computerized equipment. Where do you see sport diving going, Richie? What do you see in the future? Has it become a sport that's relegated only to those who have the means to buy into it, or are we still able to make it accessible in a safe way to as many people as possible?
I got to say, George, that's an excellent question, and if I may, I'm going to answer that in a couple of different parts. The first part is, we just look at the history of diving from my personal perspective. I was certified as a diver over 30 years ago. 30 years ago, I dove with a single steel 72 cubic foot tank filled with air, and I would basically go no deeper than about 60 to 80 feet. 80 feet was a deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, I dove with double aluminum 80s on my back and was doing regular dives to about 200 foot. Occasionally I may decompress with oxygen, but that was the limit. 10 years ago, I started diving with double steel 120s for 240 cubic foot of gas on my back. I started diving with Trimix, carrying additional bottles, stage bottles under each arm. And with that configuration, was able to dive roughly about 300 to 320 feet as a self-sufficient diver. Now, understand that open circuit technology, you could have dove to 1,000 feet, but you couldn't do it independently. You were dependent on other people bringing you other tanks. And one of the philosophies I learned a long, long time ago from those rowdy bunch of guys, the Atlantic Wreck Divers, was you never, ever, ever depend on anyone else for what you need to dive with. Now, I understand that that doesn't work when we're working as a team, when we're working on an expedition-type environment. For most sport divers, that was an excellent rule to follow. If you can only count on yourself, not to say that you shouldn't count on your buddy, but you should always carry everything you need to safely get back to the surface. So if we look at that rule, 10 years ago, diving with those double 120s, carrying stage bottles, I was limited to a dive of about 320 feet. Well, 3 years ago, I finally made the big jump to closed-circuit rebreathers. And now I'm making dives in excess of 500 feet.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm spending seven-hour bottom, excuse me, in-water times and making one-hour bottom times at 400 feet. This is something that if you had told me 10 years ago I'd be doing, I would think that you were, smelling fumes or something. There was just no figuring out that this would ever be possible. So you're asking me now to look forward and, you know, will the electro lung come back into vogue, the ability to draw oxygen directly from water? Who knows? I didn't believe that the rebreather technology would work, and now not only do I believe in it so much, but I'm actually an instructor. I'm going to be teaching people because I believed in the technology. The second part, is it accessible? Well, you know what? Everybody needs to crawl before they can run, and I would never tell anyone that they should just come into diving and go right onto a rebreather. Number one, a rebreather is a highly specialized tool. It's really for people that want to do one of three things. You either want to go down deep, or they wish to stay long, or they need stealth. Now, stealth is good for lots of things, especially if you like to photograph marine life. there's other specialized areas like cave diving or any other technical dive where it may not necessarily be deep, but the ability to have an incredibly large supply of gas, something that you could stay underwater for 7 hours, is important, as in cave diving or in wreck diving. If you were turned around or lost, instead of having only a few minutes of gas supply to figure yourself a way out, if you think about it, you could just about sit down, close your eyes, twiddle your thumbs, and wait till all the silt went back down, and then you could see your way back out again. So a rebreather does give you those options, but it comes at a cost. You know, it is pricey. Most rebreathers now are anywhere between $6,000 and $10,000. But when you think about what a rebreather will replace, not only in equipment costs, all of these other regulators, all of these stage bottles, all of these other double tanks, but also the gases that you would be using. Again, from a technical standpoint, if you're a deep diver and you're diving open circuit, you're going to use hundreds of dollars of helium and of oxygen to blend gases for these dives. But on a rebreather, you're using just minimal amounts, of like not even a few liters, because the rebreather is a thousandfold more efficient than open circuit. So, yes, it's expensive. But to the serious adventurer, to the serious explorer, this is a tool that I think they need to go with. And I think that the human spirit is not going to just stay in the shallows, because that's where open circuit scuba limits them. Right now, we are on the edge of that intermediate zone where for years scuba divers have gotten to one level, and then way beyond that was a level where submersibles have been used, roughly 1,000 feet and deeper. But from 500 or 400 feet to 1,000 feet is this relatively unexplored area of the littoral zone of our coastal areas, that there's lots of shipwrecks, there's lots of history, there are lots of stories that yet to be told. And I don't think that the insatiable curiosity that we human beings have, and that I think most divers automatically come to the sport with, is going to let that rest. So the long answer to your question is I don't believe that just the cost alone of this high-priced equipment will keep people from their destiny. So I believe that in 10 years from now, there may be better rebreathers, there may be more efficient, which is hard to imagine. It could be more efficient, but I'm positive that we will continue to refine it. And, I mean, then you've got people that are true visionaries, like Phil Newton, who's developed the one atmosphere swimming diving suit, which is like a personal, one-man, wearable submarine. Now, he hasn't gotten the bugs worked out on this, but if he does, think about it. Now, you can swim down to 2,000 feet, not worry about decompression, not worry about the bends. Just swim down there, pick up a scallop, and come on up.
Wow.
Yes,
wow.
Exactly. Sign me up for one of those suits.
Richie, on these 500-foot dives, what are you wearing for an exposure suit? Are you in a dry suit?
Yes, absolutely. Even when I am in 85-degree water, like our recent Britannic expedition, which was only 400 feet, we wear an exposure suit. We wear a dry suit with thin silhouette underwear, not very thick underwear, because even though the water is relatively warm, as you're aware, being in it for 8 hours, you will get cold. And it's amazing how cold you'll be in 85-degree water, even with a dry suit, after 6 hours. With a closed-circuit rebreather, another benefit of that is you're breathing warm, moist air. You're recirculating your own breath. So you're not breathing cold gas, cold air out of a set of tanks. So you do retain a lot of moisture and body warmth that way. So this technology is really working to help us fragile human animals as we continue to push ourselves and our limits further and further.
Oh, thank you. That's very exciting.
Thank you so much, Richie,
You're
for
very
this
welcome.
Time. I know how valuable your time is.
No, believe me, I think I hope that you can hear in my voice that I actually enjoy this. I am passionate about it. I love to speak to like-minded people, and that's what I believe I'm doing right now.
You certainly are. Thank you, sir, very much.
You're very welcome.
Richie, I just wanted to thank you for your time. It has been wonderful talking to you, and appreciate everything you've contributed.
You're very welcome.
Take care.
Everyone, have a good day now.
That's all the time we have for this show. I want to thank Richie Kohler one more time and thank my parents, George and Betty Tomasi, for sharing this opportunity. Of course, thank you for listening. We do appreciate your comments. You can call and leave us a message on the listener line at 206-222-CHAT. That's 2428. Send us an email to technorama@chuckchat.com. We love it when you reach out and interact. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find this and other terrific tech-related podcasts at friendsintech.com. We're also a member of Farpoint Media, along with dozens of other great audio programming at farpointmedia.net. If you're listening to the show by clicking on the website, there is a way to get it automatically delivered to you for free as new shows are produced. You can use iTunes, Juice, or many other programs to subscribe to the show. If you'd like more information, send us an email. Again, that's technorama@chuckchat.com. If you've enjoyed the show, tell a friend. That's a great way of showing your support. Again, thanks for listening, and a binary high five. 101.